last time.
Time don't come, my people.
Now you ready to rise?
Everett, and you're listening to The First Time here on Six Music. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. And my guest this week is a musician, composer and band leader who was born into a unique musical heritage. As the son of the godfather of Afrobeat, he grew up surrounded by a potent mix of music, culture and politics, and at an early age decided this was the path he was destined to follow. Committed to driving forward his father's legacy, he's grown into an incredible musician, outspoken activist, and exuberant personality all of his own. I'm very pleased to say my guest on The First Time this week is Shun Kuti. And you just heard Black Times, the title track from Shun Kuti and Egypt 80's 2018 album, a song imbued with the same infectious rhythms, melodies and political messages that made his father, Fela Kuti, the icon he is today. Growing up in Fela's communal compound, Calicutta, Shun was entranced by his father, but, as we'll hear, the Fela of the stage was not necessarily the Fela of the home, and we'll hear how Shun's upbringing moulded him into the musician he is now, and also how it helped him form his own strident life philosophies. But I started by asking Shun, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
The first time I was aware of music, I think for me it must have been subconscious, while in the... because my... mom was performing right until she
so
had
it was in
me.
The womb. It was just
yeah. So I was just there, you know, touring already. You know, well, music has always been a part of my life. Yeah. So I think right from the get-go, but I remember my first musical instrument was a recorder. I had this really beautiful recorder one of my older cousins gave to me as a kid. And my dad was in jail then. You know, my dad was in jail from when I was one to when I was about four.
Man,
so and this is like a really early memory, just like it's fading, and I always remember this lovely recorder, but then I saw a picture of me with it. And I knew I wasn't crazy or dreaming it up. I had this recorder.
Because it can be like the recorder in the hands of a little kid, it can be a bad noise.
Yeah, well, I had it when I was like 3. So I think that was my really first like, you know, experience with like music. You know, I just had this recorder that I really used to love playing. Yeah. You know, I don't know the tunes, if I did any tunes, but I've always been good at anything. Even though I was 3 with this recorder, I'm sure I was belting out some blues. You know, I'm sure of it.
What was the next instrument then that you were like?
The drums.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Everyone should be a drummer.
Yeah, I think, you know. And my dad then made me go classical. Because he said, if you're going to be a musician, since you're always trying to play my saxophone. Because now, you know, I was growing up, and my dad used to have his sax just laid out in the living room, all 3 of them. And I would go and just, you know, try to play. I was like 5, 6. And he said, you know, you can't, it's not a toy. You can't play with my sax.
So were they quite like special?
Yeah, you know, those are his saxes.
If you're going to pick it up, be serious.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so, and nobody could touch him anyway. I was just his kid, you know, so nobody could tell me, don't touch the sax. You know, so I was always like trying to make it sound, you know, and when I would succeed, I was really happy. So he caught me one day. He was like, it is not a toy. You know, if you really want to play music, you need to go and get classically trained on piano up until grade 5. I think that was his own way of just saying, leave my sax.
I want you out of the way.
I think it's true, though. It's just good foundation. So I started getting classically trained, playing the piano, grade 5, got back to the sax, you know, and the rest is history. I've always had music, you know, independently, like trying to learn it, trying to discover it. But in terms of also just listening to music, wow, Kalakuta had everything. All these great bands used to come through. And even when my father was in jail, I used to remember when I was 3, because we used to stay at the shrine. We had nowhere else to stay then. The Kalakuta was not built, because by the time I was born, they had already raised down the first Kalakuta. So my dad was in between homes, basically. Then he went to jail. So we used to stay in the shrine, and I used to remember the concerts. And so music has always been a part of me.
Yeah, because like normally in this show we'd say like, oh, what are the songs you can remember in the household? But for you that was like, it was just
the house
day.
Was music, you know.
Yeah, it was the house.
My own experience of music was when I started making it, and I think I was about 3 when I started making my own sound.
Yeah,
you know.
You want to be?
I wanted to be my dad.
Right,
because I tell everybody that that's how you know if anybody is truly what they say they are, you know by their kids. Because children don't know how to deceive themselves really until they become adults. So when you see really young kids trying to be like their parents, their dad or their mom, you know that mom or that dad is really like positive or like on the money.
Yeah.
You know, because you don't see a lot of priests, you know, with kids that want to be priests. I've not seen a kid that, I want to grow up and be a priest just like my dad.
I don't want to drink. I want to just live on my own in a big old building. That's the job for me. There's so many, like, myths around your growing up. Like, but can you remember the first time you were on stage? Because
yes,
the myth is, like, yeah, you were, like, tiny.
I can remember the first show. So, there's a backstory. When I told my dad I wanted to start performing on stage now.
Yeah.
Because my dad never, like, people think Fela was like, tells his children, like, you have to do music. And, you know, I think my dad, to a certain extent, wanted us to experience his music and the music life and all of that.
Yeah.
He wanted us to experience life. But I don't think he really wanted us to be, at least for me, wanted me to be a musician. He didn't think I would want to be a musician. You know, he thought it was a phase. So even when I told him I wanted to start performing, you know, was like, really? Can you sing? Okay, sing me a song. Sing me a song. You know, so I sang one of his songs to him, Sorrow, Tears and Blood. You know, that was my audition. You know, that's a good thing also when your dad is the boss. You know, the audition is quick, you know. So he said, okay, cool. When we're in the States then, I was about 8. And he said, when we get back to Lagos, you start rehearsing with the band, you know. And I've been fantasizing all my own childhood of performing in the band, you know. Finally, my break is coming. So I've been all day rehearsing the rehearsals at home. Basically, what I'm going to do while I'm rehearsing. Oh, my God, I'm going to do the splits. I'm telling you, I was a boisterous kid. Anyway, so I get on stage and I'm doing exactly what I do. I'm spinning around like Michael Jackson. I'm doing like this. But I'm getting the song completely wrong, you know. I'm missing the cues. Yeah. So my dad comes to me and says, listen, you need to, like, get the cues right. So stop jumping around. Face the band. Turn around. Face the band. And learn the cues of the song. And so I turn around, you know. Oh, my first instruction. Okay, so I turn around. I stop jumping around. And I'm facing the band, you know. Get the cues right. I sing the song and it's good. Like, oh, you got it. So he says, that's how you do the show. You know, so I took that to heart.
Yeah.
So when it was showtime, I just picked the mic and I turned around and bagged the audience and faced the band throughout. And I did the show like that. You know, so I was proud of myself. I went backstage and my dad runs back to the dressing room. You have to face the crowd, man. Okay, instruction number two. Face the crowd. You know.
But that's like, yeah. Interesting because you've got like, it's got to be tight. It's got to be on it. There's showmanship.
Yeah.
But if you're not drilled,
yeah, you got to be on it.
If you haven't got it, there's no point.
There's no point.
Yeah.
You know? So he forgot that part, you know, at the rehearsals. You know, he drilled me, but he forgot to say, okay, now you got to do the show.
Everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died. Someone just died. Police, they come, army, they come. Confusion everywhere. 7 minutes later, all don't cool down, brother. Police don't go away, army don't disappear. Them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
Them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
That is why,
yeah.
Everybody run, run, run.
I was reading a lot about you, and I didn't know that you went. How many times did you go to the Apollo in Harlem?
With my dad.
Yeah.
I think that was the show we were when I decided I wanted to be a musician.
Right, because that's one of the most important.
I think my dad was one of the last artists to play there before it was shut down that time.
Really?
I think it's reopened again now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we did that, you know.
That's a big deal. Come
yeah,
on.
Man,
like,
I mean,
just being there, side of stage.
It's Fela, I'm Fela's son. You know, it's these things. You know, like when I was growing up in Lagos and I'd go to school and people would be like, Fela is your dad.
Okay.
You know, I didn't understand.
You're just a kid.
Because Fela did not carry himself like a star.
Yeah.
You know, he slept on the floor. He, you know, he wore his pants all day. You know, my dad was the most like down to earth, basic guy. Had no jewelry. Even his underwear was handmade by the tailor at home, you know. Why are you all losing your mind? He's at home right now in his pants. Sleeping on the floor. You know, you want to go see him? Let's go. You know, and, you know, so he just never had that air about him. Even now, I have to say, like, when I think of my dad, I have to separate Fela from my dad because Fela is this larger-than-life person everybody is crazy about. You know, and my dad was this simple spiritual guy,
yeah.
You know, that didn't even go out. So by the time I knew Fela, you know, you have to realize Fela was completely different from the enigma of the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, he was more inward. He was introversial. He was no more an extrovert. He was an introvert. He just wanted to stay at home, pray to the gods, meditate. You know, that's all he was doing. You know, meditation, relaxation. When I was growing up, one of the things I was most sure of was that my dad is at home.
Mm.
My dad is at home. You know, no matter what is going on in the world, I know for a fact that my dad is at home. Never went out, except there was a show. Never stepped a foot out of the damn house, except there was a show somewhere. I'm telling you, I know for a fact, he's at home. he's definitely, for 14 years that I lived with him, you know, that I had some sense and I could remember, he only went out once and he was to go to the dentist because he lost a tooth. Yeah, I'm telling you. So and that day was like a carnival. You know, Fela is coming out during the day. As soon as my dad, the whole street came out, the whole Calakuta came out, and we're like, bye, we can't wait to see you come back.
When a person hits their teens, it's like, well, I'm going to find my thing. And I know that, like, you love Dre, and, you know, there's certain other artists you started to bring in.
Yeah.
But then you start to get, like, when you're, I don't know, 16, you're like, well, I want, this is for me as well. I want to find my own thing.
You know, there was this sweet spot in the late 80s and early 90s, just before hip-hop went fully gangster.
Yeah.
In its transformation from conscious to gangster, they watered it down. And there was just this sweet period of, like... my man's play tricks on me by the Ghetto Boys. My man's playing tricks on me. I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a
kilo. Yeah,
yeah, you know. Mm-hmm. So there were so many like dope tracks that was not like, you know, you wasn't conscious. It was just like real like fun songs. There was Crisscross. There was yes, you know, I was yeah, great. Yeah. So this was the songs that were like. Then the dancehall guys came out. Shakademos and Pliers, Patra. You know, like
it's a lot of joy in that music.
Yeah, so that's yeah. Just this little period. You know, there was just this little period before, you know, everything went to, you know, just went to the streets in 94, 95. But that was just how I, my own time. I was turning 10. You know, listening to outside funk. And in Calakuta, foreign music was banned in Calakuta. Yes, completely. So in Calakuta Republic, you could only hear African music. Fela lifted the ban on foreign music in 1994. So around the time I started playing foreign music loudly from my room.
So can you remember, like, suddenly it being kind of...
Yeah,
okay.
It was a decree in Calakuta. Foreign music is allowed again. Feel free, everybody.
Hello? I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller. I wish I had a girl who looked good, I would call her. Wish I had a rabbit in a hat with a bat and a 6-4 parlor. I wish I was like 6'9" so I can get with Leoshi, cause she don't know me, but yo, she's really fine. You know, I see her all the time, everywhere I go, and even in my dreams, I can scheme a way to make her mine. Cause I know she's living fat, her boyfriend's tall, and he plays ball, so how am I gonna compete with that? Cause when it comes to playing basketball, I'm always last to be picked, and in some cases, never picked it off. So I just lean up on the wall, or sit up in the bleachers with the rest of the girls who came to watch they man ball. Dag y'all, I never understood black, while the jocks get the fly girls, and me, I get the hood rats. I tell them scat, skittles, kabobble. Got hit with a bottle, but sit in a hospital for talking that mess. I confess it's a shame when you living in a city that's the size of a box and nobody knows your name. Glad I came to my senses, like quick, got six in my stomach. Overcome it by thoughts of me and her together, right? So when I asked her out, she said I wasn't a type. I wish I was a little bit taller, I wish I was a baller. I wish I had a girl who looked good, I would call her. Wish I had a rabbit in a hat with a bat. I wish I was a little bit
taller. You play your hip hop, you know, but everybody before back in the day, you play your. I would just turn it down. So that Fela
like
didn't hear.
Really under the covers.
So that Fela did not hear you just, you know, bumping some Bob Marley or something. Like, what is that? So, yeah, Calakuta had that those kind of weird rules, you know. So my dad, you know, growing up and listening to music around when I was growing up, that ban was lifted.
Yeah.
You know,
it widens things out.
Let me put it this way, there was a blanket ban on importation in Calakuta, basically. So Calakuta did not allow anything foreign. So music just happened to be a part of that. Let me not be like, Fela just singled out foreign music. We're not allowed to do foreign hairstyles, wear foreign made clothes, and all those kind of things. Growing up, around when I was 10, 11, music was finally liberal in Calakuta, you know, and it was the time. And I listened to a lot of stuff. And I also, being a musician, you have to understand, I was being classically trained, so I was listening to a lot of concertos, a lot of symphonies, a lot of... I wasn't listening to music just to enjoy music as a kid. Music was also something that was a job to me.
Like, yeah.
Something I was on the path of becoming good at and learning and making it a profession. So I wasn't like every... I wasn't just like a kid at home listening to music because I was angry or because I was happy or because I was wanted to lock the world out. Music was also, for me, finding myself. Just listening to see how I could be the way this person I was listening to was. You understand?
Yeah. What classical stuff really resonated with you?
Oh, I mean, this was because of my dad. My dad's favorite was Haydn. So, and that just transferred to me because we listened to a lot of Haydn together.
Another question that I often ask musicians about is when they first became politicized. But like, once again, like music, look at your grandmother. There's that was part of everything around
you. I'm
going
to blow your mind right now. I didn't get politicized until I was about 24, 25 years old.
How's that possible?
Exactly. You see, I think many people always take for granted the strength of the institutions of influence in society. You know, so growing up with my dad, and as I said to you, my dad, I didn't live with my dad. If my dad had maybe lived past when I was a teenager, maybe I would have understood him more. But I lived with him as a kid between the age of 0 and 14. And at this time, I was not only being influenced by my father. In fact, my peers were a bigger influence than my dad, which is natural. But I also had my teachers. I had television, the radio, I had government. You know, then you have the media, you have the religious institutions as well. These were all the proper channels of influence. And they did not repeat what my dad said. When I was in class, my teachers did not validate my dad's words. You know, the government did not validate it. Priests did not validate it. TV, radio did not validate it. Fela spoke alone. It was, in those days, you say it was crazy all over Nigeria. In fact, growing up as Fela's son was a stigma. I couldn't go to any of my girlfriend's house till I was about 20.
No way.
Yeah. You know?
Because you were that.
Yeah, because we were these guys that were crazy, you know? The stigma of being Fela's son. Yeah, you dating Fela's son? You know? So when Nigerians now, you know, everybody's in love with my dad, it's new to me.
So you're now?
I'm like, yeah, thank you. Now I can date your daughters, right? Anyway, so at this point as well, you know, growing up as Fela's son, it was impossible for me to really understand that message. Because I couldn't find it anywhere else. I couldn't. So my dad had died. You know, I was just a young African kid, but I had the message of my dad in my mind. I signed my first deal. Then I started to read my first non-fiction novels. Because as an African, you are educated and you believe in your education. You have to believe in it because questioning that creates cognitive dissonance. Many people don't want to deal with that, you know. So that's the first step. As soon as you first read your first non-fiction novel that deals with African existence, you begin to question your education in itself. Those pillars that you base your reality on loses their legs. You go through a bit of internal, mental turmoil, which is what a lot of people don't want to experience, you know. You know, that rebirth. When Christians say being born again, you go through that birthing pain, really. You are the mother and the child at the same time. You understand? You know, so, and then you come to a new enlightenment. And I was like, oh, so this is what my dad was talking about. That's what my dad was talking about. This is what my dad was talking about. You know, build our own institutions that understand our need from our own peculiar and particular perspective. You know, I believe that African people truly have a noble job in the world today. And many people think it's, oh, revolution, destroying the world. I believe in revolutions, but not just the way people see it. I believe that our task is to reimagine a new world and in our own way to live in that new world in a way that can inspire the world to change, because the world needs to change. Nature itself can no longer contain the hubris of man, you know, the way we push our limits and think that we are above everything. Nature itself can no longer take it. So the world needs a new system. And I believe that African people have the resources and the climate to show this new way.
Where were you when you first heard that he died?
I was okay. The day my dad, okay.
If it's okay to ask.
Yes, this is another for this is, you see, I don't know why things happen to me this way. This is why I think the ancestors have a plan for me. The day I was going to sign the contract for my first record, I got busted for the first time with marijuana in my house. Like a whole team of cops came to my house. This was in 2008.
So how old?
I was like 23.
Right.
And all these cops came and arrested me on the morning I was supposed to travel to France to sign my first deal with Total Warner Brothers. You know, so I was in jail in the morning. I was signing a deal at night, you know. The day my dad died too, you know, I was receiving a PlayStation gift in the afternoon and crying at night that I'd lost my dad. It was crazy. So my dad had a really good friend. He's dead now too. His name is Michele Avantario, you know, and he's one of the people that also made sure that I stuck, because when my dad died, my whole world completely, my dad was everything. You know, many male kids love their mom. I couldn't stand my mom. She knew this. In fact, my mom died when I was 24. We didn't become friends till I was about 21. We just didn't, we didn't agree on anything. I mean, me and my mom were like the opposite sides of a magnet.
Why was that?
I don't know. We just didn't vibe. You know, this mother and son did not vibe, you know. So I was all about my dad. I had such a strong relationship with my dad. There was no space for my mom. I think that was what she didn't like also, you know. My dad and I were really, really close. So when he died, and my dad was the first person I know that died, I'd never experienced death.
Really?
Yeah. I'd lived 14 years. Nobody close to me had died before. You know, I just know people. I knew people died, you know, but nobody I know died before. And then the first person to die was the person I loved the most in the world. So Michele was one of those people that was like, yeah, you know, he was there trying to like just keep me, my mom. So we went through all that. But the day he came, because there was already a rumor a week before that my dad was dead. So he had died in Italy. He's Italian. So he flew down. And I'd been telling him when he's coming back, I needed a PlayStation. This was 97. The first PlayStation just came out. PlayStation 1, that first one with the disc and the memory card. Mark, you know what?
Oh, yeah, man. I spent a lot of time on Tomb Raider, man. I spent a lot of time on Tomb Raider.
Hey, it was revolutionary, fam. So he was going to bring me that PlayStation. He came on the 2nd of August in the morning. I picked him up from the airport, came to the house, and he gave me the PlayStation. So I was like, yeah, you didn't forget. I was so happy, you know. So I had this PlayStation in my hand. I was coming back from his hotel to go home, to go plug it in. I just saw a crowd outside my house. I was like, why is everybody outside my house? So I went in Calcutta, you know. I saw my mom, everybody crying. Fella is dead. Fella. I was like, nah, man. That's how you guys said last week that this guy is dead. He's definitely not dead. You know, but then it was confirmed that he died that night, you know. So, listen, it's always like that with me. You know, in the morning I'm in jail, at night I'm signing a deal. You know, in the morning I'm getting the PlayStation, at night my dad is dead, you know. This is how things happen to me every day. In twos.
When troubles sleep, younger go wake up. Wait till they find. Palava, he go get you.
Palava, he go get.
Palava. When cat sleep, rat go bite him tail. Wait till he de find.
Palava, he de find.
Palava, he go get you. Oh, oh, oh.
Palava, he go get.
Palava. Lost him job, him sit down for house, him dey think of chop. Mr. Landlord, come wake him up.
That was Trouble Sleep, Yanga Wake Am from Fela Kuti's 1972 album Rofo Rofo Fight. Following the death of his father, Shun embarked on his own recording career, taking on Fela's role as a band leader. And we'll hear about those challenges right after the Six Music News.
Six Music. BBC Radio. Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30. I'm Anna Jones. A cabinet minister has defended the government's response to allegations that the MP Chris Pincher groped two men. The Work and Pensions Secretary, Therese Coffey, said a proactive decision had been made to suspend him from the Conservative Party and insisted Boris Johnson did not know of any specific claims about the MP before he was appointed Deputy Chief Whip in February. Mr. Pincher has denied six fresh allegations of inappropriate behaviour. Henry Hill is from the right-wing political blog conservative home.
The problem that Boris Johnson has is that he is a leader under pressure, and Chris Pincher has been one of the MPs who's been instrumental in running the Save Boris Johnson campaign. It is deeply problematic that we are in a position now where the Prime Minister feels that he has to rely on people who do have these, shall we say, question marks about them because they are reliable for him personally.
Russia claims it's captured the region of Luhansk in eastern Ukraine. The country's defense ministry said its troops had encircled the city of Lysychansk, the last Ukrainian stronghold in the region. But Kiev has not confirmed the reports. Yuri Sak is a spokesman for the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense. He said his country would continue to fight for the Donbas region, of which Luhansk is a part.
The battle for Donbass is not over yet. Ukraine is hopeful and continues to receive military support from our Western allies. Sooner or later, we will accumulate sufficient number of heavy artillery and other types of weaponry that will allow us to go on counteroffensive and liberate our lands, and not just the Donetsk and Luhansk region, but also other parts of Ukraine which are temporarily occupied by these war criminals and aggressors.
The chief executive of the UK Health Security Agency, Dame Jenny Harries, has warned that the number of people being admitted to hospital with COVID-19 is expected to rise further. The latest UK figures show that infections jumped by more than 500,000 in a week. An election pledge from Boris Johnson to build 40 new hospitals in England by 2030 will be reviewed by the official spending watchdog. The announcement comes after Labour raised concerns about rising costs and whether the old hospitals would really be new or just refurbished old buildings. The Department of Health and Social Care says the project is on track. Thousands of people in the Australian city of Sydney have been ordered to evacuate their homes after torrential rain led to flash flooding. Murray Watt, who's Australia's federal emergency management minister, said the state had asked for help.
The New South Wales government have requested that we provide two nighttime helicopters, Defence Force helicopters, with special equipment, particularly for potential rescues. And they have also requested that we provide 100 troops.
And the British tennis player Heather Watson is about to make her last 16 Grand Slam debut. She's up against Julia Niemeyer of Belgium on centre court at Wimbledon. Later, Britain's Cameron Norrie will face the American Tommy Paul. At 6 Music News, the next update's at 2:30.
BBC Radio
6 Music.
We'll be right back. soldiers, them not the handover. Now I fight them this step to drop the uniform. Go for Agada, so take cover them boot.
And you're listening to The First Time here on Six Music, and my guest this week is saxophonist, composer and bandleader Shun Kuti. You just heard African Soldier from Shun Kuti and the Egypt 80s album From Africa with Fury Rise, a record packed with politics and revolution, as Shun's music often is. We'll hear about the roots and branches of his philosophy over the next half an hour, but let's rejoin our conversation as Shun and myself talk about his legendary band, the Egypt 80.
Is it 14 people now in the group?
Yeah.
There is something so powerful and so energising when you get that many musicians who are all locked in, who are all doing their thing, and it's like, you know, James Brown did it, you know? George Clinton did it in that kind of world. That
big band.
The big band thing, yeah, it is. It's, I guess it's Count Basie, and it's like, yeah. it's like...
Well, you know, music is social, right? And I think this is where technology is, you know. Art and tech had always had a dance. I mean, one of the reasons why Marx are so successful is because of the beauty and the art of its creation. At one time, the sword was the highest form of military technology. The iron sword, like just splitting copper swords in half and brass swords, like, ka-chow! You know, but it still had this art, you know, they still beautify the blades, beautify the hilt, you know. So there's always been this dance with art and tech, you know. But as time has gone on, especially with music, I think maybe because a lot of musicians were not involved in the creation of the new tech that controls music today, music is losing that aspect of it that is communal and social. That means, you know, this gift is coming through me, but it's for everybody. I don't know if you get what I'm saying.
I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
Because even in the world of inventions in technology, I don't believe anybody can really invent anything. I think everything is already invented. You are just the one that could speak it in human language. You know, you didn't really invent anything. It's been there. You are just the first person to be like, okay, I can make humans understand it.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it is, you know, it's always been there. It's just there. So that's one thing today. It's also about the larger narrative of society, you know, the individualization of everything. Once something is commodified, the way music has been commodified today, it is for the benefit of an individual. And you know that the people would want the individual to be somebody involved in the work. So why don't you say it is the artist that is this individual that is making everything through this tech? But the truth is, music made $12 billion last year, and artists only got 7% of that money. Every single artist in the world, our share was 7% of that money. Someone else is actually the one making this money, you understand? But we've been sold this narrative that is killing that part of music that allows, you know, musicians to want, through you as many musicians also, to have a living, to be successful, to be engaged. You know, more and more today, musicians have to go and play in church, especially in my country. You know, you have to go and find work in a church and just play the same songs every Sunday, because on the main stages, they're just one guy and with a mic and 40 people with no mics, and, you know, that's a show. You know, so musicians are not getting the engagement that this big band could give us back in the day. I think that is what is just different with technology today. And we have to find a way for tech to dance with music, dance with art the way it used to, in the way that both fields are empowered.
I don't hear many things.
Many things.
I don't see many things.
Many things.
I don't hear many things.
Many things.
I don't see many things.
Many things.
We make me think many things.
Many things.
We tell me pass anything.
Many things.
We make me think many things.
Many things.
We tell me pass anything.
Many things.
And that's time they go.
As time they go.
More and more.
So Many Things was, it's kind of the first album, but it's not the first album, really. There was like Think, which was before that.
Yeah, but it was the first album. I had an EP before.
Yeah, yeah.
The first full length was Many Things.
Yeah, but like, can you remember being in the studio and, because that's a very different discipline as well, getting it down on tape, because there's no audience that, it's a very different skill set.
There was the Egypt 80 that I'd done it 49 times before.
Okay, fair enough. if you put it like that, they knew what they were doing.
You know, there was the Egypt 80 band, they had done it 49 times before.
Okay.
You know, I was the green Tom here. And as I said, you know, the band has always been supportive of me. I mean, they know that I put a lot on the line for them at a time where the world would rather had seen them go away.
What do you mean?
Yeah, because, you know, after my father died, what was there for the Egypt 80 band? You know, the family was like, well, we're not interested in managing the band. Fela is dead.
Because you would imagine, knowing what we know now and knowing how much those recordings...
Hindsight is 20/20.
Yeah.
You know, but at that time, nobody was thinking about that. They were just thinking about what it would cost to keep the band. What did you mean to keep the band, you know? And nobody wanted to invest that. Till now, nobody in Africa, in Nigeria, invests in the Egypt 80 in any way, shape. No corporation in Africa, no government, no nothing, you know. The Egypt 80 has survived basically by what they've been able to do after Fela, you know. I don't think, even the band doesn't even get royalties. I'll say that, facts.
Was that really bad record deals? Was that like...
Well... It's not really bad record deals. It's just basically because Fela wrote all his songs.
All right. So he had the publishing okay.
Yeah. So he, as long as they've been paid then, the powers that be today don't see any reason why the band should. And I'm a pragmatic guy. I'm also part of Fela's children. The band not getting some means I'm getting more. So I'm not even complaining on their behalf. I'm just saying the band survives on what the band is able to do today. And for me, that is something for everybody to be proud about.
Yeah.
Proud of, that is engaged with the band, because it shows that we are not successful based on Fela's work alone. Yes, we stand on his shoulder, but we are relevant in our own right. You know?
But that's a lot on your shoulders, the family and the success of this group of people. That's like, as if there wasn't enough on your shoulders anyway, here's the responsibility for this group of musicians, this group of artists, and their families and their futures.
Yeah, but they also have that responsibility too. And it has always driven us. You know, I think knowing that we only have each other and music, let's never forget the music, knowing that we only have each other and the music has always been one of the strengths of the Egypt 80. You know, we know that we are not going to leave the stage and have all the mainstream radio talking about us. You know, we could get a review from the New York Times and no blog or platform is going to pick it up and run with it and be like, yeah, yeah, you know, we are not celebrated. So we know we have to go to that stage and kill it every time so that we can keep our fans engaged and keep money coming in for the band, you know. So that's how it is.
Tell me about working with Robert Glasper.
Oh, wow.
Because, like, when did you first meet? What were your first kind of impressions? How did it work?
Bobby and I met, as I call him, Big Bobby. Big Bobby and I met in the studio for the first time. And as soon as we met for the first time in the studio, we've been talking on the phone, you know, our managers were friends.
Right.
You know, and when we spoke on the phone, like, we could do this, he wanted to do it. So he came to Belgium. He flew all the way to Belgium. And from that moment, let me just say also, like, that Robert has been like a big brother to me, not just musically, but in terms of my career, you know, putting in the good word, opening some doors, you know. And as soon as we linked, he shared my kind of sense of humor. And my sense of humor is hard to get sometimes. You need to be really, really free spirit to enjoy my personality, you know. But he got me. And I was like, you get me, you know. And we've been really close ever since.
It must be, and this is, I'm sure, something you've talked about a lot, to see over the past 10 years, Afrobeat music and everything that's come off that, especially in the UK, mm-hmm. become part of the landscape. It's no longer specialist music. It's world music. It's just music.
Yeah, but it has always just been music, you know.
Yeah.
As I said, you know, there's the institutions of the world are not as open to the world as they should be. I mean, even in the naming of the planets, you know, Europeans named the planets after themselves, all the nine planets. You know, forgetting that the world is multicultural.
That's a very good point. I've never thought about that before.
And this kind of mentality, you know, is what runs in the institutions. I say, like, there's hardly any real consideration. This is what must change. And even now that we say African music is more accepted, the range of tolerance is just more. I keep saying, you know, acceptance of African music, of African art, cannot be total when some part of African culture is still negated, because these things that we say we love about Africa all germinate from African culture. So there's still a way that imperialism dances with Africa in as much as it can commodify Africa. So whatever cannot be commodified about Africa, like the real foundational culture of Africa, is called primitive, savage, is not touched, is not invested in, is negated, you know. But whatever part of us can be commodified, like our dance, our music, our fabric, our fashion, our energy, I cannot accept this integrationist explanation and, how would I put it, definition of us as African people being accepted when it's truly tolerance. We must move towards acceptance, complete and total acceptance of the multifaceted cultures, and the world itself is so different, so much variety, and each must find a way to accept the other.
And music has a role to play.
Yes, music, politics, education, science has a role to play. You know, because most of the time people want to say music has a role to play, while other institutions like finance continue to destroy the world, and the defense and the education and the science and all of those things. You know, and they just say, oh, music, unity. No, all the institutions of the world and all the fields of the world, no matter where you work in the world, you must be engaged in trying to change the world. You must be engaged in unifying the world. This is in the department of the financial institutions. You understand? No matter how many records I make about it, you know, if they don't change in there, nothing's going to happen about it. And so I don't want us to have this utopist idea of music. Oh, music can solve everything. No, bankers can solve a lot too. Politicians can solve a lot too. Scientists can solve a lot. Teachers can solve a lot. And we need all these people, engineers and accountants and lawyers and all these people, to start solving the problem, you know.
Struggle music, struggle sound, struggle people, struggle now. 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 We'll be right back.
Are you optimistic, though? We've seen, like, you know, one would like to think that humankind is getting better. We are hopefully evolving to a more understanding tolerance of everybody. That's the idea. That's what we should, that's what we're here to do.
Mm-hmm.
How optimistic do you feel that things are getting better?
Well, I'm optimistic that things will get better with or without human beings. We can only push nature so far before nature pushes back. It has happened many times. We know this, that there have been 5 mass extinctions on this planet. And life can continue without humans. So I am optimistic that our planet will survive. Am I optimistic that humans will survive with it? No. The jury is still out, you know. And some people actually say that we've passed the tipping point in terms of the global warming, climate change situation, that humanity right now cannot reverse the damage that it has caused. You know, I don't want to think about that kind of scenario too much. But I think that in terms of saving our humanity, to re-embrace what it means to be human, you know, to be about the all and not the almighty, because you see, that mighty is the ego, you know. This is what they want to impose on us, to reflect this might is always right kind of mentality. You know, but if we see ourselves as a small part of the all, you understand, I think that is the beginning of something. You know, the individualism, the rugged individualism that capitalism allows people to embrace in the world today, you know, removes us from that all. Makes us feel like we are either equal or even above the all, based on the amount of fiat we have been able to accumulate in our lifetime or the influence we have over certain institutions. So these are the mindsets that dominate the world. And we as the people, working class, poor people, professionals of this world, we are the ones that are selling this cake to the most, and we're eating it because of the little comforts that we get from it. And we must reject that message, so that the people see that we want a better world for everybody, not a world where some people are drinking champagne all the time and some people can't even get water. You know, come on.
How do you feel about Lagos at the moment?
Needs to change. The way I feel about the whole world, you know, Lagos is home. I feel like it's home all the time. And I'm always there if I'm not working. But I feel Lagos needs to change, just the way the whole world needs to change, you know.
Do you feel people look to you?
Yes, they look to me, but I am, as they are looking to me, I'm trying as much as possible to organize them to look to themselves too. Because that's something else we need to get rid of, that African people are putting their hopes on individuals. You know, they have the Messiah complex, because we've not been educated to understand that we have the power to change the world, that every single human being is put here to make history. We are here to change the world. We are here to make the world better, and we all have the power. But the way the world is set up, you are made to feel like, oh, you are inconsequential, you know, and you cannot effect change in your own existence, you know. But if more people engage, organize, and participate, and find ideologies that are trying to change the world, you know, that are bringing about something new, you know, that speak to their conscience as human beings, I think they'll realize that they have a lot of power, the power to be with, to build with. You know, that is not tyrannical, the power that listens, the power that is dialogical, the power that does not control, but allows to work together. This is the power that is available to the people. But we think that that power is worthless. So that's where I'm optimistic, that if human beings can understand power, they will realize that they have power and they do not need tyrannical power to bring change and real change to this world.
For my looks, she come for my books. Yeah,
she wants love, a revolution.
She no want no fashion accessory. We only talk revolutionary strategy.
She wants love, a revolution.
From the time when she meets me, my soul never empty. She teach me how to love, she teach me how to walk. See my spirit worth a little more.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Why is the honor, yeah?
She respects the ancestors.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Why is the honor, yeah?
You don't wanna mess with her, I advise ya.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Why is the honor, yeah?
She blessed me with her presence, with her essence.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Why is the honor, yeah?
When I close my eyes, a fire is all I see. She say my life, it is my melody. But the people, they be the harmony. She won't live her life, she no won't live her life. Reach higher.
She want love, a revolution.
Musically, what's happening right now?
Oh, listen, I forgot why I was here. The first time I forgot something, I was here. You know? The first time. I have two songs. I recorded a live recording of two songs for my next album, Love and Revolution and Emi Aluta. I have a live recording that we did with Cloud Studios. It's going to be on YouTube. It's like a live show. But we're taking the audio and we're putting it out on Orchard so our fans can enjoy some new music before it comes out on the album. People have been loving the songs at the shows anyway. I've been playing some new material at my shows. Also, I have a project coming out with Black Thought.
Okay. Go on.
Yeah, so that's we're coming out with some remixes from the Black Times album.
Yeah.
You know, and the project is done with Black Thought, and it's completely, even if I have to say so myself, mind-blowing. My flatmate in university, Alex Jennings, known popularly as DJ Molotov, you know, made the produced the beats, and it's something really we're looking forward to doing those things. Yeah, those are the things I have right now for the people, but you know, looking forward to more things.
The last thing we ask is we ask you to pick the last track, because we'll play a song after this. And it can be one of yours, one of someone else's, something you heard this morning, something you've loved since you're a kid.
Yes. Ghetto Boys, My Mind's Playing Tricks on Me. Something ain't right.
Then that is the song we'll finish on.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
I've been chased by the same set of headlights.
It's been really good to speak to you. Thank you.
Yo, my pleasure, man.
Headlight, I can't sleep. I toss and turn. Candlesticks in the dark. Visions of bodies being burned. Four walls closing in, getting bigger. I'm paranoid, sleeping with my finger on the trigger. My mother's always stressing I ain't living right. But I ain't going out without a fight. See, every time my eyes close, I start sweating and blood starts coming out my nose. It's somebody watching the act, but I don't know who it is, so I'm watching my back. I can see them when I'm deep in the covers. When I awake, I hear a car burning rubber. He owns a black hat like I own, a black suit and a cane like my own. Some might say take a chill, B, but I can't, G, cause there's somebody trying to kill me. I'm popping in the clip when the wind blows. Every 20 seconds got me peeping out my window. Investigating the joint for traps. Checking my telephone for taps. I'm staring at the woman on the corner. It's messed up when your mind is playing tricks on you. I make big money, I drive big cars, everybody know me. It's like I'm a movie star, but late at night, something ailn't right. I feel I'm being tailed by the same sucker's headlights. Is it that fool that I ran off the block? Or is it that clown last week that I shot? Or is it the one I beat for $5,000? Thought he had cane, but it was gold, metal, flower. Reached under my seat, grab my papa for the suckers. Ain't no use to me lying, I was scared than a monster. Put the left in the Popeyes and Bell Dot quick. If it's going down, let's get it over with. Here they come, just like I figured. I got my hand on a chrome-plated trigger. When I saw, I make you start giggling. Three blind, crippling, crazy senior citizens. I live by the sword. I take my boys everywhere I go, because I'm paranoid. I keep looking over my shoulder and peeping around corners. My mind is playing tricks on me. Day by day it's more impossible to cope. I feel like I'm the one that's doing dope. Can't keep a steady hand because I'm nervous. Every Sunday morning I'm in service.
That was Mind Playing Tricks on Me by the Ghetto Boys, the final choice of my guest this week on the first time, Shun Cutie. Head to the BBC Sounds app to catch up with more episodes of the first time, including the podcast and my chat last week with the legend that is Herbie Hancock. I'll be back next Sunday from 1 p.m. and my guest will be Alex Kapronos from Franz Ferdinand. Until then, my name is Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.